Abrams is Jam.
This is Wales.
And this is Ryan.
And this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. It is the retro show for the month of January 2022. And what we usually do on these retro shows is we travel back in time. We do sort of semi-chronologically. We travel back in time 21 years. So we are going to be talking about the month of January 2020. God, my Jesus Christ. Okay, everything's fine. Starting over. Hey, everyone, this is John.
This is
January 2002. And guys, what a time to be alive.
Sure was. Seamless. Just perfect.
I'm going to fix it all in post. It's going to sound great.
You're not going to fix shit.
I am not. But yeah, this was the beginning of a new year in the post 9/11 America. We do have some historical events of some import that we can discuss if we feel like it.
I have two non-media related events to discuss.
I can't remember shit that happened 21 years ago. So
you know. You don't remember what happened yesterday.
I know, right? Who are you guys?
We're your real mom and dad. So,
God, I'm so fucked up.
When we do get to the media, we do not have very much to talk about in the world of video games. On a few things, I guess we could talk about in the world of movies and film, but nothing really super amazing to discuss. How's the music look?
Not that many albums, but I think there are a number of really good records.
Oh, that's right. There was the one that I never listened to that you said we should definitely listen to. Fuck.
That's okay.
Okay. What were the historical events you had? Why don't you kick us off?
Okay. Both are sports related.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So January 3rd was the BCS National Championship game, a college football national championship. It was the Rose Bowl. It was the Miami Hurricanes versus Nebraska Cornhuskers. In the past years, we've never talked about the college football.
We have not.
Bowl. But why is this one significant? This one's actually significant because it had the 2001 Hurricanes, the Miami Hurricanes, which is widely regarded as the best college football team ever assembled.
Oh, yeah?
Just the team alone accounted for 15 first-round picks. In the draft.
Absolutely. And then the team was decimated.
Yeah, well, not in 1 year. That was over the course of a couple of years. But that's that team. I mean, but I'm sure in that year's draft, they probably had five or six guys at least go. Just the average would tell you that many.
Who are the highlights?
So what the team combined for 43, a good way to measure how good was this team, they combined for 43 trips to the Pro Bowl as a team. This includes Ed Reed, probably the greatest strong safety to ever play the game. Andre Johnson, Frank Gore, an amazing running back. Vince Wilfork, kind of a dying position, but he is sort of a three-down nose tackle, like a guy that could just sort of stay in the middle of the line and just rush. Fantastic. Jeremy Shockey was a tight end. Jonathan Vilma, Willis McGahee, Chris Myers, Clinton Portis, Antrell Roll, Sean Taylor. It's going off my screen. There's even more people to name. Bryant McKinney and Kellen Winslow. All these guys had at least one Pro Bowl. You got five guys here at least that have to be in the Hall of Fame. Mm. Just an absolutely unreal team. Oh, and for what it's worth, in that game, they won 37-14, beating the Nebraska Cornhuskers.
Pretty convincing.
And here's the thing, 37-14, at half the score was 34-0.
They were in garbage time in the third quarter?
Basically. Yeah. So, they put up 3 points in the second half and still won by, 23 points? Mm. So
three touchdowns.
Absolutely devastating game for them. If you like college football and you're always interested in where the players play in college football, this was definitely a peak, a banner year for any one team in college football.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. My other event, do you want to bring that up too? Is another football event. In January 19th, an AFC divisional game playoff occurred between the New England Patriots and the Oakland Raiders. A game that ended in 16-13 in overtime with the Patriots winning. And you're probably, why do we care about the AFC divisional playoffs? That's when you're at your best of eight. Like, we're not even talking about the Super Bowl,
right,
which will occur in February. I guess we can bring it up then. But why are we talking about the eighth round? It's because this is the infamous Tuck Rule game. This is one of those sliding, you know, the whole sliding doors thing? It's like a sliding doors moment for all of the NFL.
Mm.
Is this one play call that occurred? Because this is when the New England Patriots, who really weren't anything special, had Tom Brady as their quarterback filling in for Drew Bledsoe. And he's in his first playoff game, right? And this play occurs where it's a tie game. It's like 13-13. Tie game. He gets tackled from behind, and he has the ball. He's holding the ball up like he's gonna, like, probably pass it.
Is he in motion?
This is the debate. This is where the debate emerges.
Oh, I think I remember this.
Yeah, one of the Oakland Raiders defenders knocks the ball out of his hand, but in doing so, pushes his hand forward.
Mm-hmm.
So what many people, and if you watch the play, like myself, I will just tell you, I think it should have been called a fumble. It really should have been called a fumble. It was called a forward pass, even though it was clear that he had no real intention of throwing the ball. It was just his hand was positioned like that, hit, ball fell out. Raiders should have recovered the ball right then and there. Not necessarily won the game, but should have been able to get the ball back. And yeah, it is now known as the infamous Tuck rule. It has spawned many conspiracy theories that the league is somehow in bed with the Patriots, but why would they? Later down the line, you'll find out that they hate the Patriots.
There's like the start of the Patriots dynasty. Like, why?
Yeah.
Why would it be at this point that they want the team from Massachusetts to be this
right
enduring franchise?
Because what would happen if they lose this game? They lose a meaningless divisional playoff game. Drew Bledsoe comes back and is the quarterback, and Tom Brady sits on the bench for who knows how long. And whenever he does end up getting a starting job, which maybe he never does, he was a 6th round pick. You know, maybe when he gets a job, would he even be any good? Now we view him as, like, the by far, like, a mile ahead, the greatest NFL player that's ever lived.
Mm.
No one is even close to what
he's like done. Him in the S tier, and then starting at the B tier, you got some other guys.
You would need to create a 2 or 3 empty ranks to put him above everybody else.
He S literally, plus Tom Brady.
He literally just threw for, like, 4,900 yards or something in there.
And he's like 53. We're talking
about... No, he's like 40. He's like 45.
He just won a playoff game, didn't he?
He will be in the playoffs this year with the Bucks.
Yeah, Tampa.
And they're going to play... Actually, a rematch of the very first game of the season. The week one opening game was Dallas Cowboys against the Bucks.
Hmm.
And the Bucks won that game. So... Monday night, tomorrow night, will be a rematch of that game. Today here in the year, what are we in, 2023 at this point?
Yeah. 21 years later, here is Tom Brady again in another playoff
But yeah, game. I mean, he just won the fucking Super Bowl 2 years ago. Like, absolutely incredible, this guy's career. And yeah, and a lot of people say, again, that sliding doors moment. What if that had been ruled a fumble, where would he be today?
I'm going to throw the prediction down now. Tom Brady is going to throw a complete pass in this playoff game.
Yeah.
The receiver will fumble it, and Tom Brady will push the person who recovers the fumble, the other team. A Dallas Cowboy will recover the fumble. Tom Brady will push him out of bounds before he breaks away from the rest of the field, and they'll rule it a safety.
I could see that.
Because that's what they do for Tom Brady.
Honestly, I think the NFL hates Tom Brady at this point.
Yeah, they're tired of him.
I think that, yeah, the whole Deflategate thing that occurred, which, again, we're talking about, if we're doing this in, I guess, 12 years, we'll talk about the fucking Deflategate scandal.
It's the Tom Brady podcast now.
Lordy.
We do have, like, at least another historical event that I think is worth mentioning. It was the beginning of the month, I think it was the 9th, that... George W. Bush, January 8th, George W. Bush, 43rd president of these United States. Twice, 2 times this guy was president. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
He signed the No Child Left Behind Act. And man, of all the shitty things George W. Bush has done, this is definitely one of them.
Yeah.
The No Child Left Behind Act, fundamentally, just being really reductive.
Sounds like a good thing just by the name.
They always name these things to sound good. Like the Patriot Act. Like, yeah, the Patriot Act. That sounds great. Don't we all want to be patriots and love the country?
We need more patriot.
Yeah.
We need
the government to be able to surveil us without our permission. But the No Child Left Behind essentially funneled federal government assistance to schools to the best performing schools. So it kept on rewarding schools that already had tons of money.
That sounds like they're leaving a lot of children behind.
Exactly. Exactly. What you should be doing is providing funds for better facilities, more teachers to schools that are not performing well on standardized testing. Because, like, there are a whole lots of problems with standardized testing in particular But in this case, what it's doing is like, hey, you're not doing well in tests, you don't get money. So the end result is bad schools stay bad. Schools with lots of money, you know, with the, where the white children are, get more money. Yeah. And it also just turns teaching into test prep.
Yeah. It you know, you would hope that you would get practical skills, practical information by going to school.
And, yep.
Yeah, it just became this sort of rhetorical exercise of how well can you do on exams. And again, exams that are oftentimes very structured to... I mean, they're just easier for white people to... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the social structure of, like, yeah. what these exams are testing on, how they're presented.
Yeah. I mean, even though they're structured to white people, that doesn't stop me from failing them.
I think you fail no matter what color your skin was last.
But yeah, it is truly ironic that they would call it the No Child Left Behind when it did disenfranchise so many kids from getting a proper education. Mm-hmm. And again, yeah, it's like, why do they name these things like this? It would be like if there was one that was called like Keep Sharks in the Water, you would know it was a bill designed to help sharks move on land. You know, that's precisely what this bill would do.
They have robot legs. Oh my God.
Don't get many ideas, Wes.
I just got a mental image yet again of the video from The Simpsons about how it's good to eat meat and the shark taking the gorilla out of the tree.
Yeah, classic war. Like, I love when it's like the little human figure and that's like all the things are arrows pointing to it. So the human gets to eat like the bat and one of them is like a boot, I want to say. It's just like all kinds of random shit. Oh, it's a great episode.
Other than that, I don't think there's any other historical events that we need to spend any time on.
I mean, it's January. Nothing's supposed to happen in January. January kind of like blows. Right.
There's the Sundance Film Festival, a movie you've probably never heard of. One, I've never heard of it either.
What's it called?
Avatar.
Personal Velocity: Three Portraits, directed by Rebecca Miller.
No, this needs to be man.
No idea. So let's move on then. Let's talk about some games, fellas.
Okay, let's do it. What do you got?
I got three games. Okay. Sadly, no GBA games of note were released in January of 2022. Pretty slow time for games, as I mentioned before. On January 7th, we got a GameCube game called Cell Damage. I only bring this one up because I made fun of the Xbox for having this game on it. And here's the GameCube version, so, well, shit.
I just remember seeing the splash art, like the image on the cover art for it, and being like, this looks fucking atrocious.
It is It's a cel-shaded Twisted Metal, is what it is. I do have some facts about it, developed by Pseudo Interactive, published by EA. Pseudo Interactive is a game development studio that started in 1995. They were closed by 2006. The only thing interesting about Pseudo Interactive is that some of the people who worked at that studio end up spinning off and becoming Drinkbox in 2008. And Drinkbox, you might recognize them from games like Guacamelee or Nobody Saves the World, which is a game that I really liked that came out this past year. It was received pretty poorly. It sold really poorly. Never got a sequel. They did pitch a sequel, which is surprising. They ported the game to 360 and PS3 back in that generation. I'm going to use copy of this game for $20. You shouldn't. You should not. But that's it for the GameCube. So
that is probably the single cheapest title you could get secondhand for a GameCube.
Yeah, it's maybe
$20.
Maybe.
Sounds about the worst.
There are a couple of GameCube games, or sorry, PS2 games.
I mean, it's a ton of sports stuff. I guess I see so many things titled Salt Lake 2002. I'm guessing the U.S. was hosting the Winter Olympics around this time, or will be in the next couple months.
Sounds about right. the GameCube, like, hope you still got your copy of Smash Brothers, because it's probably what you're playing in January. Maybe you're still working your way through Pikmin, but, you know, it came out beginning December. You're probably done with it.
Smash Brothers is one of those games that just sort of, like, exists and is. It's always there, you know?
You're never not playing Smash Brothers.
Right.
We're playing Smash Brothers right now.
Mm-hmm. And loving it.
Couple of PS2 games. They were both ports of Dreamcast games, so not a super exciting month for the PS2 either.
Are we going to bring up Rez?
Rez? Yep.
Yeah. Rez is a cool game.
Oh, so this game developed by United Artists, United Game Artists, published by Sega. You know this game?
Yes.
You played it?
Yeah. Oh, I love it. It's great.
Break it down.
I had a burned copy on my Dreamcast.
Amazing.
Because this was a hard game to get a hold of. I believe this was a Japan only game.
Maybe on the Dreamcast?
Not Japan only, but like it was much more popular in Japan than it was in America. It's essentially a geometry rhythm, not shooter, but a rhythm game that you play with a really intense kind of like jungle house soundtrack to it. Really, really cool and colorful and abstract. Like again, it was very much like that Tron, like what Tron thought the future would be.
Sure.
It's kind of like what Tron was without the, the actual rotoscoped humans acting in it. Well, you know, it was just a really, really fun game. A nice take on, again, a killer soundtrack. Really, really fun soundtrack. So, I never played it on a PlayStation 2, but I for sure remember playing this on Dreamcast and loved it.
You know, this studio, United Game Artists, they're a subsidiary of Sega, or they were a subsidiary of Sega. They were absorbed into Sonic Team in 2003, not too much longer after this game came out. And like you were saying, it's a pretty well-regarded Dreamcast music rhythm game. Pretty well-received overall. Sold very poorly on PS2, maybe 200,000, 250,000 worldwide. So, not great. It does get an HD port on the 360 and then the PS4, so still available there. You can also get it on your Oculus. So you can play this game in VR, which is probably pretty cool.
Yeah, it's one of those games where it's like, it was never successful, but everyone just talks about how great it was.
So this would be cool just in VR.
Sticks around.
You get a used copy for PS2 for about $40. You should. I wonder how much that is on Oculus. It's probably like if you got your, $800 VR set, maybe they'll give it to you for free. I don't know.
Possibly.
It's only $400.
Oh, okay. Only $400.
It burns the eyes out of your skull.
The last one that I got for the PS2 is Grandia 2. Which is, again, like I was saying, another Dreamcast game that was ported over to PS2. This one was developed by Game Arts and published by Enix. This was before the Square and Enix merger. This studio, Game Arts, they've been around since the mid-80s and used to be much more prolific. The only really major series, and, major is a relative term, but the Lunar series and the Grandia series are supposed like their highlights, and they're like C or D tier JRPG franchises. But Game Arts also co-developed Smash Brothers Brawl back on the Wii way back in the day.
Interesting.
And they haven't really done much since. They've pretty much been doing these Grandia HD ports for a few different systems. Rocket Studio did the PS2 port. Couldn't find any information on them. Kind of seems like they were just a porting studio specialist. But Grandia, it is a JRPG with a twist on the sort of Final Fantasy active time bar turn-taking mechanic. So when you're in a battle, all of the characters are sort of moving on one time bar. You see like their little icons moving across, and you initiate commands. And what you'll do is certain actions will do things to interrupt. You can see the enemies on this time bar as well. Certain actions will interrupt them. So if you're using a combo attack, you will interrupt them when they're in a certain segment of the bar. And if you're using a counter attack, you'll interrupt them in a different segment. And the advantage of interrupting them is it resets them so you can avoid taking damage if you're timing your attacks and using the ones correctly. So pretty neat little twist on that system. There's a game called Child of Light back on Wii U that did a really similar thing that's worth checking out. The battles are not random, which is great. You can see all the enemies on the field, so you can choose to encounter them or not. Characters do have their own like classes with specific skills and skill sets, and, things like DPS and your mages and things like that. But you do also have some like modular nature to what you can do. You can have ones learn different types of spells. So you can kind of cross-pollinate jobs if you feel like it and do things like upgrade skills. You get rewards in fights that will do things that will upgrade not only your active skills but also your passive skills. So you can do things like spec out characters to do things like draw aggro but be really evasive. So some fun customization stuff you can do with that. Puzzles and dungeons don't really amount to much more than like pushing blocks or finding a switch. They're not very intricate. The game also doesn't look particularly inspiring. And it is a port of a Dreamcast game, so it gets a little bit of leeway there. It's kind of like an isometric view. Kind of like the next step in evolution of what you think of like as a PS1 JRPG. The game isn't super long. Takes about 30 to 35 hours to work your way through. It's really unfortunate for this game that it came out mere weeks after Final Fantasy X. It's a bit of a bummer for them. Because like Final Fantasy X is this huge step forward in JRPGs, not only, especially in presentation and in Blitzball. But and this game is very much a throwback of a JRPG. It does some interesting things with the battles, but it's no surprise that this game gets totally overshadowed by Final Fantasy X. I think this is a game that's worth a shot for JRPG enthusiasts. But like Final Fantasy X, especially since you're in Grandia 2, you're getting a 30 to 35 hour JRPG experience. Final Fantasy X, you're going to spend hundreds of hours in that game just doing the monster arena and tinkering with different weapon builds and things like that if you get really into it. So you get a lot of bang for your buck. A PS2 copy of this game will run you about $45. It was received pretty well, especially on the Dreamcast. It reviewed quite well. Doesn't really go on to sell very much at all. You can get a brand new HD collection of Grandia 1 and 2 on your Switch for $40. So you get two games for less than the price of what you'd buy the PS2 disc for.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. And it is a game that has gone on sale a couple of times. So if you just kind of wishlist it, you'll probably see it drop to, $20 before very long.
I see this also got a PC port as well.
Yes.
Or not even a port. It came out in March 2002.
Oh, nice.
So this thing's been on PC for a while as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like how Grandia kind of got its foothold back into, I guess, the consciousness for at least JRPG enthusiasts. Is through PC, because it does eventually also release an HD port on Steam and GOG, and then you get the console releases after that. So yeah, that's it for the games.
What game you missed out on?
Oh, which one?
Probably should talk about a PC game. And granted, like, everything had a fucking Salt Lake game. I feel like, what were there, some other sports ones? ESPN, Winter Games, Xbox, or no, X Games, Snowboarding 2002? Whatever, don't care about that. I wonder if I got Medal of Honor Allied Assault.
Okay.
One of the better selling Windows or PC games that you're going to get.
And these games do also get console versions at some point.
Yeah, well, actually, there's a thing. I guess we'll talk about the other version later, but this year there's also going to be a game called Medal of Honor Frontline.
Mm-hmm.
And Frontline is also going to be on the PC as well, but it's going to come out on all the different consoles as well. I think even the GameCube gets it.
Yeah, the GameCube does at least get a version. Maybe a couple versions of Medal of Honor. But it's an interesting series because it kind of predates Call of Duty.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, and this one ended up being, at least up until like 2006, this was going to be like one of the top 10 selling PC games.
Oh shit, okay.
So this game's going to do very, very well for itself. Or I should say 21st century games. It's going to be one of the better selling games of the next few years, which really didn't even sell that many. I want to say it was like 6 million copies or something like that. But still very, very successful.
Two Luigi's Mansions.
Yeah, two Luigi's Mansions.
Is that how we're going to just rate it from now on?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, man, that game sold four Luigi's Mansions.
That'd be impressive. That's like Grand Theft Auto 3 numbers.
Yeah. Not much to say about it. I actually really didn't even play this game. I just remember that it was supposed to be a much more like down-to-earth, realistic, like militaristic thing. It was supposed to sort of tell the same sort of storming of Normandy as Saving Private Ryan, and then there was like this whole narrative. It was a very, very, very much a narrative-driven first-person shooter.
Yeah, and that's something that I don't have my finger on the pulse of the first-person shooter genre, but you don't really, especially through the 90s, you don't really see and too many of like those militaristic, like having World War II as a setting for these first-person shooter games. Medal of Honor comes along, and Call of Duty will come along as well. And Call of Duty doesn't really become the major first-person franchise until like probably Modern Warfare, mm-hmm. where it gets super huge. But yeah, for a little while after Medal of Honor, you get a few of these scattered around.
Oh, this was the one note I did want to make about it. They're apparently using the id Tech 3 engine, which is the same engine that was used for Heavy Metal Fact 2. I don't know if you guys remember us talking about this.
The movie? It was the game.
It was a game, a movie, and an album.
Yeah, yeah.
That all came out at the same time.
Uh-huh.
I loved it because I watched. I mean, all three of them I experienced in various mediums.
You just had like a day where you just absorbed yourself into Heavy Metal 2.
Oh, but the game was
Heavy Metal 2000. Was it 2000?
Yeah, Heavy Metal 2000 was that, and then Fact 2 was the game. So this game, Fact 2, is actually really, really good. I know it looks like it should be bad. It's not a bad game. It's a really good game. And the engine was used to make a fucking Medal of Honor Allied Assault. I think it's very impressive.
Hmm.
So, thought that was just a cool footnote.
Yeah, very cool.
Mm-hmm.
Before we move on from games here and into some other topics, I did want to at least give a preview. We will have Nintendo games to talk about throughout the year, for 2023, when we're looking back at 2022. So some notable GBA games coming up. Just next month, we'll be talking about...
Lilo and Stitch Pinball.
Lilo and Stitch Pinball?
Just kidding. Of course. January 1st release.
but Lilo and Stitch, I don't think that movie comes out until...
It'll be
like the middle of the year?
Something like that. Hey, let's not bury the lead, man.
Okay.
There's going to be a wild year for movies, but that's another topic.
But in next month, in February, we'll be talking about games like Sonic Advance, Super Mario World, Super Mario Advance 2. They'll keep that series going. But we'll get Mario World on the GBA, which is great. Tactics Ogre, Mega Man Zero, we'll be talking about later in the year, as well as Undo Castlevania, Harmony of Dissonance, and Yoshi's Island. There's a version of Doom 2 for the GBA, which is wild.
Okay.
Contra the Alien Wars, we'll get a version of Contra 3. Metroid Fusion, a Monkey Ball game, a Phantasy Star Collection. There's a Kirby game, Nightmare in Dreamland, and to wrap up the end of the year, we'll be talking about Link to the Past. I have a version on the GBA.
Thanks.
So yeah, very cool. It's a nice lineup and a pretty good mix of like new games as well as like some Super Nintendo games. It'll be nice to revisit those because we haven't done that in quite some time. But as far as the GameCube go on the home console front, we'll get the first Sonic game released on a Nintendo console, Sonic Adventure 2.
Hmm.
Gauntlet Dark Legacy, which is a game that Wes has stories about.
I never have mentioned that story.
Burnout, Resident Evil, the Resident Evil remake, you guys, is coming out this year. That's great. That's an amazing remake. Eternal Darkness is a cool GameCube game. Another Monkey Ball game. We'll get two Monkey Ball games to talk about this year. Mario Sunshine, the original Animal Crossing, Star Fox Adventures, Time Splitters 2, Mario Party 4, Tony Hawk 4, if you wanna, I guess. Yeah. Phantasy Star Online Episodes 1 and 2. There's a little game called Cubivore, which is kind of a cult classic and a super expensive game. That one's a really rare pickup. Sonic Mega Collection. Resident Evil Zero, a brand new Resident Evil game for the GameCube. Metroid Prime, fellas. And then a couple Star Wars games toward the end of the year. It's cool. So there is stuff to look forward to. So that we'll be able to talk about. And of course, we'll revisit the Sony system as well, as it is appropriate.
Yeah.
But those are the only three systems. GBA, GameCube, and PS2.
I think so. I think you covered them all.
Oh, PC. Almost forgot PC.
PC, of course. Well, yeah, the two handheld. Yeah, the handheld.
Yeah.
And they were still making Game Boy Color games, I'm sure. Probably some of those to talk about.
Off to check real quick, but I think we might have... It's possible we may have dried up the well for Game Boy Color games. But yeah. Where do you guys want to go next?
We can just do music. We have been doing music. Just,
yep.
Then we'll just move on into
we'll
film.
Take care of music.
Let's all do right. it.
Cool. I'll take my nap.
Yeah, not a lot of records to talk about. I think, though, each of my... As usual, I break them down in my individual categories. I feel like every category had a good month. Like, no matter what, even if you didn't have a lot of records, each one had some great music. And again, January is a dumping ground. Like, I know last year was the weird year because we had that J-Lo record come out, which was a fucking huge deal. But that was kind of a unexpected hit.
Yeah, I remember that.
I'm just saying, I'm as someone that really does track these things pretty closely.
You went to the tour when when it came through Tampa. You
hitchhiked
there because you were 12 at the time.
Yeah, I was probably about to say 13.
Okay. All right. Let's get to it. So
you beat me to the math. I couldn't do that math. I was like, how old was I? 21.
So in the world of pop rock, the biggest album of the month, a band I had never heard of until this, a band called The No Twist, NOTWIST.
Oh man, I don't know them either.
Yeah, they released an album called Neon Golden, and this is apparently their fifth album. They're a German indie rock group. I actually really love this record. I thought it was beautiful. I think it's a fantastic listen, It's sort of this nice combination of a band we've talked about from the past 2 years, microphones mixing in with Radioheads, more electronic experimentation with what the conventions of indie rock should be. Very gentle vocals and very laid back. Just really nice. I don't know. It takes its time. It's not really there to try to make any big singles happen or anything. And the last couple tracks are just instrumental. So, like, it's just a really fun record. And then you get the last 10 to 12 minutes of it, and it's all just these beautiful instrumentals. So, really, really loved this record. Just it just became like a go-to record to listen to for the month. I just super enjoyed it, and it's a really fun band. Never heard of them. I don't plan on going back and listening to their first four, but I'll keep an eye out for their sixth album whenever that thing rolls around. You guys heard of Nine Inch Nails? You guys know Nine Inch Nails?
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Okay.
I've heard of them.
Yeah, so in this month, he releases, he being Trent Reznor. Trent Reznor is essentially the, atop of being the inspiration for those Triceratopses that shoot fire at you from Super Mario World. he is the main guy behind...
He's the front man.
Behind Nine Inch Nails, yeah. He's sort of the creative mind of it.
He's a carpenter?
Stop it.
I don't know. Not sure about that. But yeah, so he releases a double album of sorts. It's this weird compilation where the first half is a live album, which I'm not going to talk about. It's actually a really bad live album. It sounds like shit. I wouldn't recommend anyone.
Like a bootleg?
No, it's not even a bootleg. It's official. They officially released it. It's just one of those ones that doesn't make the music sound any better. The recording feels very distant, and then there's a lot of just fan noise over it. Which is something that you control as the maker of a live album. You determine how much fan noise is there. And they decided to leave in a lot of fan noise.
But someone listened to it and was like, yeah, this is fine.
Right. I mean, if you want to see this band rock it live, they did, I think, Woodstock 94. Hmm. And fucking slayed. That was a wild performance. So yeah, Nine Inch Nails is probably a really good live band, but that album doesn't capture it. What does happen, though, is the other half of this is an album called Still. It's a B-sides record. And I don't really know. It's kind of an odd one. Fans of Nine Inch Nails really like this one. And I would not consider myself a fan, but I really like Nine Inch Nails. I mean, I like, you know, what Pretty Hate Machine and Downward Spiral and Fragile, the albums that came out before this, I like Nine Inch Nails a lot. But this is, like, kind of boring and amateurish, I hate to say. A lot of it is, like, him singing over just, like, piano renditions of his famous, some of his other older songs, which is like all he's doing is sort of pounding out these really simple power chords. And he has a voice that's good for harsh industrial pop music, but really bad for intimate solo recordings.
Like, how strange is this? Is like a greatest hits kind of, like,
I wouldn't even call it a greatest hits. It's sort of certain songs he wanted to do reinterpretations of.
Okay.
On piano, just again, some of this is just pianos and keys. Some of it is
how self-indulgent.
Atmosphere, very, very self-indulgent. No, the best track on here is actually the second track, which is just a solo piano piece that he doesn't sing over, which is sad that's your best track on this thing. And the last two tracks are ambient tracks, and I like ambient music, but I think if you were a fan of Nine Inch Nails and you bought this album, you would be like, what did I just buy? Why are you doing this?
You know? Mr. Reznor, Trent, get on this podcast, explain yourself. But, and then we're going to talk about the soundtrack to The Social Network.
Yes. Well, that's the other thing, is that he's going to start getting much more heavily into ambient music, into making soundtracks and things like that. I still love Nine Inch Nails. I think this is good. I think this album's just kind of a boring messed up, and unless you're like a really big fan of Nine Inch Nails, you probably should skip this one. Mm. One of my buddies, his favorite band is Nine Inch Nails, and he's like, yeah, there's one really good song on it. So that should tell you something. Like, it's just not there. And he'll have this album called With Teeth come out, I think, 2 or 3 years after this. So maybe like 2004, I want to say. And it's another really, really good record. So Nine Inch Nails will continue to make good music. This is just an odd compilation that I didn't think needs to exist. One more album in pop rock. It is Autumn's Gray Solace, an album called Within the Depths of a Darkened Forest.
Oh.
Yeah, I know it's a lot
wordy. Of
it's ethereal dream pop, if you like that sort of thing. Kind of like, it's, I feel like the sound of 80s dream pop has sort of been coming back. nowadays in the year 2022 and 2023, but like this is 20 years prior to that, which is looking at something 20 years prior to that. So this is a weird frame of reference.
It's convoluted.
But anyway, I'll say it again. This is a mouthful. Autumn's Gray Solace, Within the Depths of a Darkened Forest. They're actually based out of St. Augustine, Florida. One of America's oldest cities produced this band. They've kind of got this steady following. They've never really broken big and made like a big single or a big album, but they have been very influential and they've released over 13 albums. It's a lot of acoustic guitar and piano with this woman who's a very like feminine, high pitched, kind of wispy voice over it. It's a very moody record. It's enjoyable. It's good. I would recommend it, but only if any of that sounds interesting. Onto hip-hop and R&B. Wow. Hip-hop and R&B had a really, really good month, but it's all very, very similar. For starters, you've got MF Doom. MF Doom released Metal Fingers Special Herbs Volume 2. It's technically Volume 1 and 2, though.
So okay.
Don't let him fool you. He's got you both covered right there. It's interesting. He's going to make these... I think he makes up to 10. But he always has these things called Metal Fingers, Special Herbs, Volume, whatever. Every track is named after a different spice that you would use in making food.
Okay.
So it's got its cute little thing. What is it? It's not really designed for like loops to be rapped over. Like a lot of these tracks would not translate well to someone like him producing hip hop for another artist. These are really just kind of soulful instrumental grooves. Again, not really hitting you with any hard beats that you would really think would fit into hip hop, but on the whole, just an absolutely fantastic vibe. I think anyone, like, you guys probably watched a little bit of Adult Swim.
Right? Yeah.
You know? Do you remember how Adult Swim just always had those groovy beats when they would do the bumps? They'd do the black screen with the white text and you'd hear a nice loop. You were probably listening to a lot of these Special Herbs compilations. Huh. MF Doom is a really, really big part of that. Absolutely fantastic. He just passed away, I believe, last year.
Oh, shit.
Under mysterious circumstances. He just sort of...
Skydiver.
He died, and nobody told anybody until, like, 2 months after his death. His publicist came out and said it, because his family refused to acknowledge it. Very strange circumstances there, but whatever.
Quick side note. Wes, you mentioned skydiving. Barbara Walters.
Mm-hmm.
Passed away just recently. Famous journalist.
That's right. Yeah.
From skydiving?
No. Okay. But I was at work, and it was like the day after she had died. She was 93. Lived a good long life. Probably a fantastic lady we'd never met. And I was at work, and someone was like, "Oh yeah, Barbara Walters died. It's so surprising." And I said, "Is it?" Mm-hmm. She was 93. Is it surprising?
It's like saying Betty White just died.
That she died.
Yeah, I mean she had a good run.
Right. And
we should all hope to make it to 93. I mean, if we have our health about us.
Right. It was.
I'll be lucky to make it next week.
It made me think of it because you said skydiving, because like I was one of those little mini rides. Like, was it surprising that she, like, what did you expect? Like, how is it that you think that she died? Her parachute didn't open? No, she was 93. Good for her for making it that far.
Man, that'd be the way to go. 93-year-old dies skydiving.
When you get to 93, I will push you out of a plane. That will be my birthday gift to you at 93. In your wheelchair.
Just go wheeling to the side of the plane.
Out.
Off to hell you go.
Oh, amazing. We now know our last words to each other.
All right, moving on. Yeah, so the MF Doom record, real solid. Another artist, MF Grimm. Now, MF Grimm is based... Oh, I didn't mention it earlier. MF Doom is actually from England. You don't hear a lot of hip-hop coming out of England, but, you know, he's a producer who is from England. MF Grimm is actually from New York City, and he has been friends with MF Doom, which is why they kind of share that same naming convention.
What's MF stand for?
Metal Fingers. The compilations are called Metal Fingers.
I thought it was going to be motherfucking.
I was just about to say the same thing in my head.
Motherfucking Doom!
Yeah, Dr. Pepper mouth. I was just about to do that. I was like, fuck, beat me! Motherfucking Doom!
So yeah, MF Grimm is a producer himself. He is really tight with MF Doom. He releases this album called The Downfall of Ibalis, a ghetto opera. Another big mouthful of an album.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It's this is another just fantastic album. He's very like-minded with MF Doom in that he uses a lot of just very chill lo-fi production and a lot of little a little bit of that New York big beat sound that works so well. I got to tell you about this guy's just fucking journey as a human being, though. This is just one of the wildest stories in, I think, all of popular music. So he was born in New York. He was neighbors with Morgan Freeman, who arranged for him to be on Sesame Street. This was his big break into the mainstream.
The fuck?
Right?
Morgan Freeman's a gentleman, and he'll help a kid out.
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, what's Morgan Freeman's tied to Sesame Street?
He's fucking famous. That's what his talent is.
Yeah, he's like, what are you fucking watching?
You're not famous until you're on Sesame Street.
Morgan Freeman on Sesame Street?
Everyone makes a guest appearance on Sesame Street.
No, he just got him a job.
He just decided.
He's probably got like a talent scout that he's probably got an agent, and he's just like, hey, here's this kid in my neighborhood who wants some acting gigs. What can we make happen for him?
Oh, okay. Morgan Freeman believes in children's television programming, sir.
Okay. No, my mistake. That's going to be a dark day when he skydives.
This is like, this is, by the way, like chapter 1 of 20 of this guy's life. Can I move on?
We're going to comment on every chapter, too.
He begins a rap career in the late 80s. This sort of gets him into that, working with the likes of MC Light, really, MC Shidey, some really big 80s hip-hop names. This was all going well for him until he was shot 7 times in 1994, survived but was left paralyzed and bound and wheelchair-bound. In the late 90s, he has, of course, developed this friendship with MF Doom. Of all things, a shared love of comics. Both of them are just super dorks. And they sort of, the two of them sort of begin working on music together.
Which comics does it say?
I don't even remember. We'll talk about it in a minute. Again, there's 20 chapters of this guy's life. There's a lot to get to here. Okay, so after this, so get this. He records this album in 24 hours. This one album is recorded in 24 hours. While on bail for $100,000 for a life sentence he's about to serve. For nonviolent crime narcotics possession. He was arrested under what you call Rockefeller laws. These were basically discriminatory laws designed to sentence, you know, urban youth to life sentences for drug crimes.
Shit.
It's a truly extreme one-strike law. And
like, how much does they have to be in possession of for that's absurd.
I didn't look in to find out what it was. It could have been heroin, or it could have been crack or cocaine or something like that. But yeah, that's all it took. And again, it's the Rockefeller laws. These are specific to the state of New York. So he bails for 24 hours and records this album. This entire album is sort of his life journey up until this point, and just some sort of venting, realizing he's about to go into prison for the rest of what he believes will be the rest of his life. Thankfully, it's not, because what he does is he spends the next 3 years in prison studying law and takes his course to the appellate courts. Not only gets his sentence reduced to 3 years, essentially for time served, he then helps dozens of other kids like him who were put into extreme sentences for, again, possession crimes. So, absolutely incredible. This guy is so smart. I think it's so fascinating that he did this, that he took the time that he was going to spend for the rest of his life in prison, just studied law and found a way to, you know, get himself out of, to exonerate himself, essentially. Not even exonerate, that's not fair. He did serve a few years, but ultimately he was released in 2004. So he would then go to work with MF Doom at Vertigo Comics, making an autobiographical series that would win him multiple awards. He still has this media empire of making comics, still making music. It's absolutely wild. I think it's incredible how he came from the darkest stuff. Again, being shot and put in a wheelchair, to being sentenced to life in prison, to being a critically acclaimed MC and comic creator. Like, very, very cool. Very, very cool. So, damn, that is this guy's life. Fascinating to learn about him. And this is just a really good album in general. So, moving on. Devin the Dude released an album called Just Trying to Live. Devin the Dude is from Houston, Texas. So, Southern hip hop is, of course, a big thing. If Devin the Dude were anything, he's just sort of like Southern hip hop's answer to Snoop Dogg. A lot of really chill, laid back rhymes, and you know, a lot of content about marijuana. You know, expect a lot of rhymes about smoking weed. It's got a lot of good production. Dr. Dre is on here, DJ Premier, an unknown at the time, David Banner. David Banner will be a big producer in the mid-2000s. You know, it's fun. It's good. It's a little one-dimensional, of course, and if you just bristle at, you know, lyrics about weed, you're not going to like this record at all. But all around, just think of it as, again, Southern Snoop Dogg. It's a fun record. Esoteric and 7L released an album called Dangerous Connection. We literally just talked about them, like, 8 months ago. They had just released their debut album, Soul Purpose. This is, they're already back again with another record. Again, more of these jazz loops, that kind of New York sound. Absolutely love them. Really, really love this band. This is a great record. They remind me a lot of, like, Jedi Mind Tricks. If people like them, listen to them. Very good. Another album from a band called, or from an artist named Jest, J-E-H-S-T. He is actually an English rapper and producer, and at the time, England, I guess, really didn't have a very big hip-hop scene, or at least if they did, it was very underground, and this is regarded as, like, a breakthrough record for them, and holy shit, it sounds fantastic. If you listen to it, you would have no, you would think this just is a product of Philadelphia or New York. You would not think that this was an English hip-hop record. And I think when I listen to a lot of, I mean, personally, this is my personal opinion on it, when you listen to a lot of music from England, they try to make it clear that they're not from America. Like, no matter what the genre is, they always find a way to differentiate their sound from the American sound, as though their sound is in some way superior to America's sound. This is an album that does not care that it sounds like an American hip-hop record. You can tell he clearly loves, especially the New York sound of hip-hop. And it shows. Really good beats, really fun rhymes. Instant fan. Never heard of this guy. Instant fan, though. Really enjoyed this record. Okay. On to punk. We have... I think we'll probably get to the end of the year and look back and say this was the best punk album of the year. It is Bad Religion's Process of Belief. We talked about them a year and a half ago. I love that we now are talking about all of these artists who we just talked... What feels to me like we just talked about. But they had just come out with an album called New America back in 2000... which was sort of revitalizing the group. This was one of those bands that was like a legacy act for punk. Mm. This is one of those really important, like the 70s creates punk, right? Some of the 70 artists, but in the 80s, it took bands like, you know, Bad Religion and The Descendants to come along. Black Flag, artists like that really kind of kept punk alive and kept it moving through the 80s.
And yeah, you had the shift to the hardcore punk.
Yeah, yeah.
In the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm. Just keeping it fresh, giving it something new. And Bad Religion was always there for it. And if you were to go up until the year 2000, you would probably be like, Bad Religion, the band that has fallen off terribly. They had made some bad records, and they just were not the band that they used to be. And New America showed that they still had it in them, and this album is maybe their best ever. Like, this is even considering the classics that they made, like Against the Grain and Suffer, How Could Hell Be Any Worse? All these are classic punk records from the 80s, but this may be their best fucking record, Process of Belief. I love it. I absolutely love this band. The big thing that helps is that they got back their guitarist, Brett Gerowitz, who left for a while, but now he's back in the fold. And it's everything you want from just a high-flying skate punk record. The riffs are incredible. It's so melodic. The velocity on this record is unbelievable. It's so tight and well-produced and crisp and all... sounds so lush and big. And the vocals, they have this, like, this is a band that has a lot of songs that are, obviously, they're called Bad Religion. They have a lot of issues with organized religion in general and a lot of issues with societal structure in the first place, but that's neither here nor there. But this is a band that uses, like, choir vocal harmonies at the back of their music. So all of these just soaringly beautiful vocal arrangements over someone that's not full of piss and vinegar and yelling at you about anything, just a very gentle and I don't know, deliberate and thoughtful voice delivering a mature message over just this gnarly skate punk. Absolutely love this record. I just can't get enough of it. I was so happy to see this one come up on rotation. I love this record. I've listened to it since it came out, you know, and I still listen to it today. Love it just as much. Moving on, The Distillers released Sing Sing Death House. This is another kind of like epitaph skate band of sorts, famous for the fact that their singer is Brody Dale. Brody Dale was married to Tim Armstrong as well. Oh gosh, what's his name? The Dirtbag from Key Us. that got in a fight with him was married to her as well. So,
okay,
just going first full circle, she would ultimately
how incestuous of them.
Strong. And then I was like, neither here nor there. It's fine. Her voice is awful. Her voice is just awful.
She can't sing.
No, she can sing. It's just the everything about her voice is pretty wretched. Kind of like Courtney Love. Like, there is a kind of a charm to Courtney Love's kind of caterwauling.
I think it's funny because you didn't say kind of like Courtney Love's singing. So to me, it was just like kind of like Courtney Love, just terrible. Just
I don't know. You say these things about Courtney Love. I mean, eventually Kurt couldn't stand her anymore.
Yeah, hey, you know, we don't got to get into all that. You know, she might have been the one that, you know, was involved in those events.
Or implicated. Allegedly.
I'm kidding. He was a heroin addict that was depressed. I am not shocked a man like that would kill himself. Mm. Yeah.
Skydiving.
Yeah, skydiving, huh?
With a shotgun.
With a needle in his arm.
What was that line from Mystery Men? Oh, the police said he fell down an elevator shaft onto some bullets.
Chuck Norris jokes are pretty lame, I think.
Of course.
They're a little played out.
Especially considering what Kentucky Perverse and Chuck Norris is.
Yeah. I actually heard one recently. It was like, did you hear about Chuck Norris's skydiving accident?
Oh, God.
Yeah, he returned the parachute.
It's amazing.
It's kind of clever. You don't get slam a revolving door.
All right. We gotta go with a new person for these. It doesn't have to be Chuck Norris.
Your faces are such, like, in pain that I'm telling you these
jokes. The revolving door one was good. Slam a revolving door.
At any rate, we'll move past this record. I think it's kind of a fun one. It actually had a track that charted as a hit.
What about Denzel Washington?
City of Angels.
Could he be the new Chuck Norris?
Oh, he doesn't like, could he sing for fucking the Distillers? Like, I guess he could. He probably could. Yeah.
He seems like a better person than Chuck Norris.
Yeah.
Did you know Chuck Norris?
What?
What's wrong with Chuck Norris?
Oh, he's like weirdly like right wing and
he's a pretty hardline conservative. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We're gonna talk about one of those guys when we do our movies.
Amazing.
Wait, you're telling me Walker Texas Ranger is white
right? Right. We should have seen it coming. But he like borderline like end of the year, end of the world, like holding the cardboard sign outside of a fucking Home Depot, sort of thing, like hellfire and brimstone. Anyway, that's not music.
Remember when Bruce Lee, like, ripped a chunk of his chest hair out during a fight?
Yeah, he deserved it.
That was pretty impressive, right? Okay, moving on. One quick mention. There's a band called Race Bannon that released a record called In the Grips of Light. It's an oddball noise rock album. Kind of hard to listen to if you don't like noise rock, and it's not the best listen if you do. It's fine. It's what it is. Only complaint is that the album's 52 minutes long.
Oh my god.
Most noise rock bands, knowing that they make harsh music, don't make 52 minute records. They typically make a 20-25 minute experience. No. They decided to go all out.
Yeah, 52 minutes, that's more than half a Morbius.
Yeah, so, yeah. both technically are harsh and atonal. So into electronic and ambient music, we've got the Chemical Brothers releasing Come With Us. This is actually a big record, or not, this is actually their only kind of not big record. Hmm. In terms of, like, these guys were really big in the 90s when the big beat sound was going, and they had a bunch of like, really huge singles that carried, you know, multi-platinum records. And this is their first album where kind of doesn't have that big lead single. Which is fine, though. Actually, I think it's all in all, it's a really good record. Even if it doesn't have like, the Chemical Brothers are a band. They're still active today, but they're kind of fit for today. Like, they're very much into like meme, janky sounds in their albums that would like create hit singles. So, it's just kind of there. It's a really good record. It's got a lot of great house tracks on it. Very listenable. It's just that I don't know. They just didn't want to make this have a bunch of super out there oddball samples that would maybe catch people's ear. But they didn't need it. It was a fine record anyways. Johan Johansson an Icelandic composer. He releases his debut album called Engelborn. He is more into modern classical than he is into ambient. His album is a mixture of piano and strings provided by a string quartet, and some experimental electronic stuff mixed in, but it's all ultimately very classical in nature. Really great record. This guy's actually going to go on to produce a lot of soundtracks too. He'll be kind of a film score composer as well. But a very, very good record. A lot of piano and organ, like I said, mixed in with these string quartets used in a lot of unconventional ways. Feels like modern classical, but it fits most appropriately into the world of ambient. You have an Irish group I love called God is an Astronaut. They released The End of the Beginning as their debut record. Again, a very cinematic band. They make kind of post-rock, but not like in these long, sweeping 10-minute tracks. They're sort of like in these 3 to 4 minute long, kind of spacey prog rock tracks. Absolutely love them. They sound fantastic. Again, a ton of beautiful melodic leads will be all throughout these records. Just like if you like spacey progress and prog rock that doesn't require a bunch of technical skill and just has beautiful soundscapes. Really, really good record. This one, I believe, is pronounced Drexia. It's Drexciya. Album's called Harnessed the Storm. So, little backstory. We talked about this guy already. He had an album called The Other People Place come out last year. It was a really good record of like ambient techno. And this is an album of actual like Detroit techno. Again, probably like you guys don't listen to techno, so like, why am I getting into all this niche shit about techno?
Somebody who listens
for our three listeners.
If anyone cares about techno, there is a sound specifically called Detroit Nick techno. Would you guess it's from Detroit? But
is it windows smashing and things burning?
No, but it's...
Oh my god!
It's meant to denote a very raw, grimy aesthetic. One of very minimal, like, drum machines and stuff.
I just thought, you're lying in bed, you have a tough time going to sleep, you're like, what should I listen to tonight? Sounds of the Rainforest. Detroit. Detroit. Smashing it.
That one person you were talking about who really likes Detroit techno also really loves Detroit and stopped listening.
Great, we just lost half our listener base.
Yeah, no, not meant to denote urban chaos as much as it is just supposed to evoke an aesthetic. It's very much like that sort of modern, I feel like the vaporwave that's come back would listen to this record and love it. Again, it's that minimal 80s aesthetic of just drum machines, not a lot of like synth leads and things like that. I think there's one track that maybe had some vocals, as I recall, but for the most part, it was just a super chill record. Sadly, the guy behind it, James Stinton, I mean, I don't know if I'll bring it up later on, but in about 6 or 7 months, he's going to die. He will pass away. Very, very sad. That he left us with two really amazing records right before he passed. It would have been interesting to see what this guy could have come up with if he had a little more time left on this earth, because he gave us two really good records to close out on. One last album, our boy Steve Roach. Steve Roach is back at it again here. Steve Roach has an album called Streams and Currents, one of the most prolific composers in the world of ambient. Clearly, Wes's favorite.
Sorry. I've been up since 7.
He's got that Steve Roach tattoo.
Yeah, that's right. So we talked about him last year because he released an album called Serpent's Lair, which was about the red reptilian race, about the ancient reptilian
race. Oh, that's right. I remember that. Seeded
life on Earth.
Oh, yeah.
So he's back. He's good. He's
all right.
I love this. That album had a lot of percussion. This is zero percussion. This is just beautiful, blissed, spaced out ambient. It's like 6 tracks and it's 70 minutes long. This is one of those perfect sleepy time records. This is one of those records to just kind of just drift off into the ether. You probably don't want to listen to your Detroit techno when you go to bed at night, but you could definitely listen to Steve Roach's Streams and Currents. Love it. Love it. Absolutely. Just, again, no beats, thankfully. Just beautiful soundscapes. I believe one of the tracks here is actually like 28 minutes long. And it's maybe the best on the record. Absolutely recommend it if you can handle not having a lot of melody and structure and stuff like that. It's great. Into metal, we got 5 metal records, and then believe it or not, guys, we're done. Dream Theater. Dream Theater released the 6 Degrees of Inner Turbulence. I don't like progressive metal, and this is progressive metal. It is, they are from Boston, and this is like a 90-minute epic.
Oh God, that's a long time to listen to them.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot of
they're,
stuff.
They're a lot of like fast-paced, like shredding.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, there is quite a bit of this. I think if you were to look at modern, what you would consider "quote unquote" like modern prog rock, this is one of the biggest names in modern prog. You know, meaning that this isn't like fucking Yes or Rush or something, or like a really old band. This is I think Dream Theater is considered one of the more modern outfits, and they're led by John Petrucci and Mike Portnoy, who are regarded as two of the best guitarists and drummers, respectively, in progressive rock. Expect that though. A lot of really technical. Hi-fi, just ridiculous music. It's really good, and this is regarded as one of their best records. I just don't like progressive rock all that much, so it really wasn't for me. But again, very, very good. Like it'll make top lists of best prog rock albums ever made. So a band called Sun O released "Flight of the Behemoth." This is probably the single most challenging record on this list, and what we've talked about in a long time. I personally really like Sun O. But what they're doing is, this is a drone record of basically layers of guitar distortion. So these are very long tracks that are just, I mean, it sounds, someone described it as like you were listening to the sounds of a broken refrigerator from another room. You know, it's okay. Just imagine that big walls of distortion layered over one another. You would just think you were listening to some kind of like mechanical malfunction or grinding. But really what it is you're listening to is guitar tones. You know, not that fact that someone's playing specific notes on a guitar, just the tone that can be produced from feedback of a guitar. As you can imagine, this is really popular with stoners. This is, that's not going to escape anybody. They're responsible for this
playing the guitar without playing the guitar, man.
Yeah. I mean, they are a really, really cool band. And it's the same thing as like what Steve Roach does. Like Steve Roach is making these beautiful ethereal things that you can close your eyes and feel like you're drifting off into space. And you can just imagine all these beautiful constellations and shit. And I feel like Sun O, what they're doing is trying to bury you in as much darkness as they can with these. They're making everything seem so heavy and mechanical. It's just designed to kind of smother you and as music goes. I'm not kidding. This is one of the most challenging records we've talked about in a while, but I personally think is rewarding. I don't know if I necessarily recommend it unless that sounds like something you would enjoy, but very, very good. Oh, and these guys made fucking Southern Lord Records. Southern Lord Records is a really important record label for heavy metal in general. I personally own, I wouldn't exaggerate. I probably own at least 20 or 30 records from this label. Right. Absolutely love them. Band I'm excited to talk about called Bolt Thrower. Bolt Thrower released Honor, Valor, Pride. So we've talked about our death metal, and I won't go too crazy about it, but death metal comes from just a handful of places, right? We've talked about Florida producing a lot of death metal.
Sure, Tampa.
Yep, Tampa, Florida. They fucking love their death metal in Tampa. New York produces a lot of death metal. In Sweden, or not Sweden, but just the Scandinavian nations produce a lot of death metal. Not one outlier, but one of the biggest outliers of this is Bolt Thrower, and they come from England. And they are fucking fantastic. I absolutely love the band Bolt Thrower. They're so, so good. A lot of the best death metal that comes out of England starts from grindcore bands like Napalm Death and Carcass, but Bolt Thrower is probably the most important band from that scene. And they've been active since the late 80s, so they've been around a long time. This is their 7th album. Not their best. I will say it's not their best, but it's still a really fucking good record. This is a band that just...
B+?
Yeah, they don't make bad albums. Yeah, totally. It's a B+ record. And I think what makes them special, what makes them different from all of the other bands is like... You know, the bands in the Scandinavian nations are obsessed with atmosphere and creating these giant guitar tones and giving you all of these like esoteric lyrics and like not necessarily just inherently satanic stuff, but like pagan stuff and all this weird occultist shit. And then the bands in Tampa are all about making just gross, gory, nasty shit that's like inspired by like horror films.
It's understandable from Tampa.
I wonder what you hear when you play those records backwards.
Oh, I don't even know.
Dolly Parton.
Yeah, know, they're just they're just obsessed with like gross out gory stuff. And if you listen to the New York Sound is very much built around hardcore punk. If anything, it's about making these big mosh moments and just, again, very much like the Tampa with a little bit of distinction.
I wonder if I'll put my conspiracy theory hat on. What's right? Right? Like, I wonder if like, some of that just comes from like where it's like a 10-gallon hat. Yeah.
It's a really big hat.
It's like a tinfoil hat.
Just like the environments that they just exist in. Like Scandinavia is just sparsely populated, very naturalistic, cold a lot. Yes. So like there's this like probably a deeper connection with the environment and nature, just like the land where you exist. Whereas Tampa's just gross.
Yeah, so no, Tampa's totally gross. They're probably just imagining what is that red tide that happens over there? Where just the ocean. Oh
God, the red tide is the worst.
I was watching our buddy Brian in the Discord group like sent me a video where a guy like describes the five regions of Florida, and he was wrong a little bit. He was mostly right, but wrong a little bit. He was like, oh yeah, there's Miami and the Everglades and Tampa and Central Florida and Jacksonville, and that's it. And like close. In Florida, you got your major regions. You got Jacksonville, where you're almost to the south up there, but it's still pretty metropolitan.
You had to go pre-north to almost get to the south.
Right. You have like the greater Orlando area, Seminole County, Orange County, Orlando. Miami down south, Daytona, like sort of like the East Coast beach area.
We got two coasts and they're totally different from one another.
Right, Tampa, which is the other side, the gross side. Yeah. So those are like your five major metropolitan areas. I'm not counting Tallahassee for obvious reasons. And then the rest of Florida is just the south. You got these five little dots throughout Florida.
I can
see
that.
And then you're just in the south.
I think if you were to break up Florida, it would be into three states. Mm. I think that you would take the panhandle in the northernmost part and say that's the south. That like
just absorb those into Alabama and Mississippi.
Even if it is the northernmost part of Florida, it's the southernmost part of Florida in the traditional sense of what it means to be southern.
Yep.
And then you have the middle of the state, which is like, I don't know. I feel like we're surprisingly liberal across the board. I mean, we're the only part.
Where most of the people are, certainly.
I don't even know what state to compare us to because, I mean, we have coasts on both sides, so interesting. But I feel like if you take that I-4 corridor, essentially, that consists of Tampa, St. Pete, Orlando, and then into Daytona, Cocoa, you kind of have like a mini California in a weird way. It's just its own little thing. And then you have the south part of Florida, which is probably the most Hispanic part of any part of America. I mean, aside from being southern Texas, probably a little more Hispanic.
Puerto Rico.
But yeah,
pretty Hispanic.
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily a state, but that's still a territory. It's true.
Working on it.
Yeah.
If they want to be.
So that's why I would divide it up, because it's got such a large Hispanic population there. I feel like that those are the three states of Florida, and no, Florida is one state.
Yep. Where were we?
Oh, we were talking about Bolt Thrower.
Yes.
Who is from England? So I was kind of just going to describe what their sound is generally, and I think they take the best, like what works well from all these different scenes and incorporate it into their own, which is that they do have this very pristine production, and then they still take the pummeling double bass that you hear in a lot of like the Tampa bands, and they just layer on top of it just fucking tons of crushing riffs that are all end up being still pretty melodic. Like, it's actually surprisingly listenable, and then you just have some guttural caveman vocals on top of that. And it creates this just really just brutal sound that is unique to itself. It really is not like they're trying to fit into anyone else's scene. They really do have their own thing going. Oh, and then probably the coolest thing about the band is that all of their songs are very historically accurately about war. Whereas, again, like I was saying, some bands are writing songs about esoteric shit and the devil, and other ones are just writing horror film gore level lyrics. And you know, this band is like has albums that are themed around the Crusades.
Interesting.
Themed around the Vietnam War. All their albums take inspiration from warfare at different points in mankind. And it really does create, I don't know, a sense of gravitas. It kind of elevates what they're doing a little bit more than, frankly, a lot of what the other stuff is. Where it's like, okay, this is sillier. Okay, this is gross. This band, you actually kind of listen to and be like, man, warfare is truly brutal, and these guys are capturing it. Wow, wow, wow. Oh, and if you're going to go listen to this band, like Realms of Chaos, really fucking good record. Fourth Crusade, you should go listen to. Mercenary, really good for victory. Is a great record. And then this one's a good one.
I remember this knowledge. I swear. Dear God.
I think Bolt Thrower is one of the best death metal bands.
If you like a giraffe rig that has another brain in his ass, like, I don't... Dear God.
Yeah. I'm talking out of it, apparently.
Well, you know, when you get really into this stuff, you absorb it. I'm sure Wes could tell us a lot about Persona right now.
yeah. I mean, I haven't been it yet, so...
You'll get there.
We're almost done. Two more albums.
All right, here we go.
I'm almost done with you guys. Sorry about this.
No,
it's okay. You know, you're good.
We've been sidetracking you.
Yeah. Skydiving chat.
You probably could have been done with this 10 minutes ago.
All right. Burnt by the Sun is from Jersey. They released an album called Soundtrack to the Personal Revolution. I like Burnt by the Sun all right. They're not that amazing. It's 10 tracks and 29 minutes of just... pretty blistering metalcore. I like this band a lot because of the producer of the group, Matt Bayless. We'll talk about him later with other albums that he produces down the line, but really, really great sound. He manages to be both crisp and thick with his production sound. All of the drums are really like just kind of like fat and wet and in your face, and then the bass lines are huge. If you listen to this guy,
you're like, like fist in a mayonnaise jar. Just
compare it. So a band to compare it to, you guys,
just your fucking face.
You guys are being gross.
It's like ashamed but proud of himself at the same time.
I would recommend someone go back and listen to like Slayer's Rain and Blood. And there's a lot of, you know, double bass on that record. But the drums are very, like, precise and kind of muted and distant. This guy, when he produces a record, it feels like your face is, like, in the middle of the drum kit. It's just very fucking loud.
Or the mayonnaise jar.
You're right there with the mayonnaise jar. Yeah. And again, the bass lines are way heavier. A lot of bands just don't have bass. A lot of bands don't like to put the bass forward. For whatever reason, and I think he centers his productions around this idea that you have to have a good rhythm section to make something, you know, full and big and loud. And that's what he does with this band, Burnt by the Sun. And he will do with other albums, and a guy named David Witt, who is the drummer for Discordance Axes, is on here. It's a great record. It's a really good record. It's a nasty one, but it's good. A band called Take, T-A-A-K-E. Releases Over Bjorgen Grotter Himmerich.
Amazing. Again, one more time.
He's from Norway. Over Bjorgen Grotter Himmerich.
Is that the name of the album?
The album translates to Heaven Cries Over Bergen. Bergen is a town in Norway.
That is such a Norwegian name.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So it is, as you can imagine, it's Norwegian black metal. These guys have been around for a while. In modern times, they've been around for a while. I believe this is only their second album, but they're going to release a bunch of records thereafter. It's really hard-hitting Norwegian black metal. This is really dirty shit. If you like black metal, it's a good record. The grotesque vocals and a lot of tremolo guitar work that you would come to expect. Lots of just high BPM drum work. They capture the vibe and atmosphere very well. There is this weird thing, though. Don't know why I couldn't find anybody that everyone brings it up when they're talking about this record, but no one can explain why it happens. But the third track has this weird, like, cartoonish boing sound. I kid you not, it just happens on the
just
track.
One time,
no, repeatedly.
Oh, like, oh,
probably
fascinating.
Every 10 to 15 seconds. It's hard to describe, but
he was like, fucking with everybody.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a Looney Tunes song. I kid you not, if you heard this thing, you'd be like, the fuck is going on here? Because it's like a rough, it's a tough listen overall. And then you get to that moment and you're just like, it doesn't make any sense, but God, it makes you laugh. And that's it. That's all the music. That's
very
all
good.
The music. I think a lot of really interesting stuff here for various scenes.
What's the big highlight this month?
Bad Religion, right?
I think, yeah, the No Twist, again, that first album we talked about, I absolutely loved. And yeah, that Bad Religion record is just remarkably great. Like, I fucking love it. And I'll say God is an Astronaut. God is an Astronaut has released a really good record as well. It's just, all of these are great records in their own way.
I really like the name of that. God is an Astronaut.
That's really cool. Yeah.